Hi, I'm Rob Nadelson. Welcome to How the Supreme Court Rewrote the Constitution, 1937 to 1944. This is part four in this series, and it's entitled A Packed Court and a Federal Land Grab. President Franklin D. Roosevelt failed in his famous effort to pack the court by expanding its size, partly because Chief Justice Charles Evans Hughes politically outmaneuvered him. However, FDR was able to achieve his ultimate goals by nominating replacements for retiring justices. He didn't nominate seasoned jurists. In fact, with one exception, none of his nominees had ever served full time as a judge. Instead, he chose New Deal activists, including a few of undoubted talent, willing to sacrifice the Constitution for the sake of the liberal agenda. The retirement of Justice Willis Van Deventer in the spring of 1937 created the president's first appointment opportunity. He chose Senator Hugo Black of Alabama, presumably as a reward for Black's support for the New Deal. The appointment certainly wasn't based on merit. Black's only judicial experience was 2 years as a part-time city court judge. Justice Black was still on the bench when I was in law school. Our liberal faculty members portrayed him as a lovable, crusty old man with an idiosyncratic theory of First Amendment free speech. They didn't discuss Black's early years on the bench, when he freely invented reasons why Congress and the administration could do almost anything they wanted to. A good illustration is Black's concurring opinion in the 1939 case of Coleman versus Miller. In his opinion, Black claimed, disregarding both history and constitutional text, that Congress had, quote, exclusive power over the entire constitutional amendment procedure. According to Black's hypothesis, Congress could do anything it wished with the procedure, and the courts had no way of responding. Obviously, if this notion had prevailed, Congress would have become omnipotent, altering the Constitution almost at will. Black actually persuaded three of his colleagues to sign on to this absurd opinion. Fortunately, Chief Justice Hughes had better sense. His opinion for the court charted a much more moderate course. In subsequent years, Hughes has been vindicated, as judges at all levels have soundly and unanimously adopted his view and rejected Black's. In early 1938, FDR nominated his Solicitor General, Stanley Reed, to replace the retiring George Sutherland. Like Black, Reed proved to be a reliable member of the "feds are all powerful" school of constitutional thought. Roosevelt's appointment of Reed paid off almost immediately when Reed wrote an opinion for the court dismantling the Constitution's restraints on federal land ownership. Power over land is power over people. When government acquires or retains land, the liberal media say the government is conserving it or preserving it, but those are euphemisms. What government ownership usually means is that the power of the bureaucrats administering the land is greater and the freedom of the people is less. The 1787 Constitutional Convention considered allowing the federal government to hold vast tracts of real estate in perpetuity, but the convention rejected the idea. Most of the Constitution's framers understood that limiting the federal government requires limiting federal land ownership. The Constitution's Property Clause is Article 4, Section 3, Clause 1. The Property Clause governs federal land ownership within state boundaries. It grants Congress unqualified authority to dispose of land, but it does not grant any unqualified power to acquire land. The Constitution's Enclave Clause is Article 1, Section 8, Clause 17. The Enclave Clause governs the power to acquire not federal ownership, but federal jurisdiction over territory within state boundaries. The document's text, coupled with its history, shows that the federal government may acquire ownership or jurisdiction over acreage dedicated to one or more of the purposes enumerated, that is to say, listed, in the Constitution. But the Constitution grants no authority to acquire parcels merely because the government thinks they'd be nice to have. Property acquired in excess of constitutional needs, such as that obtained by international treaty, must be disposed of. The Enclave Clause thus speaks only of a capital district and, quote, needful buildings. As the Constitution uses the word, buildings means improvements of all kinds, not only enclosed structure. However, buildings doesn't encompass vast tracts of territory. Before 1938, Supreme Court cases on federal enclaves involved areas of limited size dedicated to enumerated purposes, such as navigational facilities, which are included in Congress's commerce power, and military installations. With the exception of the enclave called Washington, D.C., which the Constitution authorizes explicitly, these enclaves are relatively small. Now, Yosemite National Park spans 748,000 acres. It obviously is not a needful building, as the Constitution uses the term. And in fact, Yosemite National Park serves no purpose mentioned in the Constitution. What it is a precious environmental and recreational preserve worthy of preserving, protected, being protected, and managed, but by a fiduciary trust, or perhaps by the state of California, not by the highly politicized federal government. Nevertheless, in Collins versus Yosemite Park and Curry Company, the Supreme Court ruled that California's cession, its grant of Yosemite to the federal government, was valid under the Enclave Clause. Only Justice James McReynolds dissented. Ever since, the clause has permitted the feds to own or control land almost without limitation. Readers without experience in the American West may not appreciate how damaging the case of Collins versus Yosemite Park and Curry Company has been. The case ratified the power of federal bureaucrats and politicians over 28% of American real estate. This real estate is disproportionately in western states. The feds own well over 80% of Nevada, over 60% of Alaska, Idaho, and Utah, and more than half of Oregon. Most of this land has no unique value, and there's no reason for the federal government to own it. We're not talking about national parks here. There's no reason for the federal government to own it other than for political power. Almost everyone agrees that the quality of federal management hasn't been high. Additionally, federal land ownership enables the bureaucracy and the special interests that thrive on federal control to manipulate voters and officials within Western states, thereby impeding local self-government and seriously distorting the entire constitutional balance.